But yeah, I think we just have to put up with other people not sounding great. That's how it is.
As long as I sound good. Do you understand? As long as I sound
you
good.
You don't sound bad. You just sound like you're on Skype or Zoom. You don't sound like you're in the same room on a like we used to sound.
No, no, you're missing my point. I have to sound good. I don't care how you sound. I don't care how it's just me. Just about me. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. This is the 26th of September, 2020, and the reason I've dated it, my co-host Kirsten McDermott, hello, by the way.
Hi, we don't usually date it, but there we go.
No, but the reason I've dated it is because in 2 days, Melbourne, as distinct from regional Victoria, is out of stage 4 restrictions.
Aren't you still in stage 4? They're just lessened. But aren't you technically still in stage 4?
No. Well, so they're calling it steps now, step 1, 2 and 3 and 4.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we're in a sort of stage 3.5, I suppose. It's a bit hitty. We don't know because tomorrow our premier is coming out to say that maybe we'll even have more things open.
Well, your numbers have been looking good, so.
Yes, they have. Of course, you can just run around free and easy. I don't even think you've got the 5K radius anymore.
No, we don't.
Bloody Ballarat. And you had snow yesterday. Did you have snow in Wendouree?
Oh, my God. Well, I was in town because I was working, obviously, and it was amazing. It was seriously amazing. I've not seen snow like that.
Wait. You were in town, as in you get to go to your office.
I've told you I've been going back to my office since May. We had half a dozen of us had special dispensation to go back because it's especially back then the technology wasn't working, and those of us who were struggling.
I'm just very jealous, all right? I'm just jealous.
So, it has been weird because I have been, even when we've been in you know, stay-at-home restrictions and all that sort of stuff, for me it has been slightly weird because I've been going to work every day and it's kind of strange. But, yeah, at the moment all of Ballarat is just at stage 1, so we can, you know, still social distancing. There's still limits on how many people can gather in a enclosed space and all that sort of stuff, but there's no more, you know, stay at home except for particular reasons or any of that. So we're feeling really, really lucky. Hoping that you guys in Melbourne get your restrictions lifted as soon as possible. But it's the numbers are looking good. I'm keeping an eye on
them every
day.
Yeah, we're down to 12 today.
So you're running total, which should lessen really quickly. Yesterday I think was still about 29, your 14-day running
26
total.
Today.
But it's you've had a week of like in the mid to low teens, so that total should start to come down. So what do you need 5, don't you? Less than 5 by October 28 to have the 5K lifted?
Yeah, between 0 and 5.
Mm.
Yeah, to get to where you're at. Because, of course, you're running 14-day total is 0.6.
Yeah, it's not even 1. Even half a person feels a bit sick. So
yes, correct.
just their left half, their right half is fine.
Anyway, enough about coronavirus.
Yes.
Let's get on to books.
Let's get on to books. It is not a COVID podcast.
Which I enjoyed both of.
Oh, my God. I adored them both.
Oh, thank God.
I had such a fun month.
I know we're discussing it second, but I had a fear about the Lies Dictionary.
Adored that book. I adored it.
But then when they started going on about Mount Weasels, Kirsten's going to be in for this one. The Mount Weasel is going to get to Kirsten. I knew it.
Which one are we going to talk about first?
Folk. We're going to go to folk first. But I just needed to talk about Mount Weasels.
Yeah. So off the bat, I adored both of these books. Love them so much. Was sad when they ended. It's that kind of book. Like, it was kind of sad when it ended because, like, oh, you're gone now. And especially we're going to start with folk, right? So let's introduce folk and then talk about it. That would be polite.
Okay. So first off, I just want to get one thing clear. Mm-hmm. I think I said at last month's podcast that I introduced folk to you and you made up some.
Oh my God. Did you do some forensic internet research and find a post or something?
Yes. I did. I went back to my Facebook where I first mentioned folk and the very first post to my comment on folk is you saying, must add this to my, you know, my list of books, must buy it now. Now, to be fair, you could argue that you were aware of the book at that stage. You just hadn't purchased it or done anything in terms of buying it. But the way you speak in that post makes me think that, yes, it was me, Ian Mond Esquire.
Did you get a law degree?
No, but if I did, Esquire would be about right. Folk by Zoe Gilbert is I Am the Man Who Introduced You to Folk.
Okay. I want to reinforce your obsessive internet forensic habits, but okay, I'll give you it. I know Lisa Hannett also recommended it to me and a few people recommended that book to me, but you may have been the first. I don't 100% remember.
Guess you make them aware of it.
I will give you that.
Go back to that original post because I actually call you, and there's a reason, and this we'll talk about it. In that post, I call yourself, Angela Slater, and Lisa out. Lisa there. Handed out in that post because folk very, which we keep saying the title, I'm not saying what it's about, but folk very much reminded me of your work.
Oh, that's
especially
so nice.
Especially, because you were doing fairy tale stuff. Mm.
Okay. And Lisa those and Angela be, very, yes, I can see. Absolutely. Yes. we
and
should
the
also
argument
say.
I made,
oh, yes, keep going.
Yeah, and the argument I made in that post, and this is now gets into the actual subject matter. Is that folk is, I love folk. I think it's great. But it's first off, it's classed as a novel. I don't know if you noticed that.
Oh, we'll talk about that.
But second off, it's very much, it was at the time in 2018, a literary darling. It was getting a lot of press and justified. It's a great book. It deserves it. But what shat me a little bit was there are so many good writers like Angela and Lisa writing this stuff, whatever this you want to define this stuff to be,
it's
who
fantasy.
Just don't get noticed.
It's fantasy what that is. That stuff is fantasy.
Yes, fantasy, yes. who are right, but that's sort of folk tale-ish type fantasy or one stuff that's influenced deeply by European folk tales, etc. Mm. They are hands deep in it, and yet this book was treated as if it was a new wonderful
Well,
first
yeah, but it's that usual thing, right, where Zoe Gilbert, and we should say, I don't know that we have said Folk is authored by Zoe Gilbert, and came out of the literary scene. So she was publishing short fiction in literary markets and so on. So we've had this discussion. Like a lot of it is provenance of where the author has come from, which you know, pathways through publishing the author has made. So whereas Andrew and Lisa have been slumming about in dirty, dirty spec fic land. So... You know, we don't need to have the discussion again.
Okay, good. Mm. So we should stop there and I should get onto the blurb because
yes, before we get too much into the book.
Yes, because context is good.
It is good.
What the hell are
we
talking about? All right, Folk by Zoe Gilbert. The remote island village of Neverness is a world far from our time and place. The air hangs rich with the coconut scent of gorse and the salty bite of the sea. Harsh winds scour the rocky coastline. The villagers' lives are inseparable from nature and its enchantments. Verlin Webb, born with a wing for an arm, unfurls his feathers in a defiance of past shame. Plum is snatched by a water bull and dragged to his lair. Little Crab Scary takes his first run through the gorse maze. Madden sleepwalks through violent storms haunted by horses and her father's wishes. As the tales of this island community interweave over the course of a generation, their earthy desires, resentments, idle gossip, and painful losses create a staggeringly original world, crackling with echoes of ancient folklore, but entirely wonderfully her own. Zoe Gilbert's Folk is a dark, beautiful, and intoxicating debut. And that actually is a pretty decent blurb.
It's a really good blurb, yeah. Yeah, there's a shortened version of it on the physical book itself, but yeah, it's a really good blurb.
And really says everything you need to say about the book. So let's move on to the next book.
Okay, liked it, thumbs up, off we go.
Well, I was going to say that basically sums up everything I want to say about the book. So let's move on to the Eli Williams. No, I'm kidding. That was a joke. That was a bad joke. So I read Folk originally in 2018.
And I just read it this month.
Beg your pardon?
Only just read it this month, finally, having had it on my list for almost exactly that amount of time.
Yes, exactly. Oh, wait, really?
I know, so weird.
I did reread it, though, because so I'd forgotten huge chunks of it, and yet, and it's one of those things when you do reread, about halfway through, and we should say how it's structured. So, okay, let's go back to say how it's structured, which is essentially it's a set of linked short stories.
It's a mosaic. It's called a novel. It's a mosaic, and we've had this podcast.
I know, and we don't want to go back there again, but it is a debut novel. That's how it's been sold.
Because it's hard to – well, it's hard to sell a short story collection, which it isn't quite anyway, and you don't want to have to explain to people what a mosaic is, I guess. But it's a mosaic. Exactly. That's what it is. And it's
so about halfway through the book, I started remembering. It all came back to me, and I knew exactly what was going on, which is good, which is fine, and it was still enjoyable. And I loved it as much the second time that I read it the first time. So – as it says in the back cover blurb, you've got a bunch of characters in this place, Neverness. Actually, where do you think that Neverness is set?
So like a real world analog type thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I was reading it, I definitely got, a feeling of somewhere European, Western European, coastal, obviously, or you know, an island. Maybe because it was written in English, probably UK sort of Celtic type vibe from it. And then later, after I had read the book, in doing a bit of reading around it, I did come across a mention that Zoe Gilbert had been inspired to a significant extent by the Isle of Man in terms of the physicality of her fictional location of Neverness. So that gelled with kind of the picture I had in my head, I guess. But it's also down to the language and the description of the natural world in the book. So a lot of the plants and the, I guess, the landscape and things that she describes felt to me, quite Western European, UK-ish sort of, Celtic kind of thing. That's the vibe I got. How about you?
Yeah, look, well, I don't usually get a vibe on this sort of stuff because if it's not Jewish folk tales, I know nothing.
Yeah, but in terms of the oh, so well, you're talking more. You're talking more about
the UK to me. She's a UK writer, so it felt like the UK to me.
But are you talking more about sort of the origins of the like some of the motifs and things that she uses?
Yeah. So the bald stuff, which I suppose is like Mithras or whatever. I don't even – is that right?
Yeah. So, look, there's a lot of Celtic stuff. There's a lot of nods to, I guess, the – fairy tales
it's not
difficult.
The point I'm making is it's not my tradition. I know nothing about Celtic. I mean, I do – obviously, I've absorbed it because I'm stuck in this Gentile world and I'm in, you know. God, did I say that? Could I have said that any more horribly?
It's quite the sneer to that word.
That should be the quote of this podcast. This is a Gentile world. If it was Talmudic stuff or Midrashic stuff, I'd be all over it. I'd know exactly what was going on. But the Selkie means nothing to me. Does this have?
It's not really, a Selkie, but it touches on that.
One who has the misty stuff.
I think so Zoe Gilbert has created a lot of very novel things, but coming out of a tradition. And with lots of nods to things. So like, I can't remember his name, but the man who has the swan wing.
Verlin.
That's it. So to me anyway, clearly a reference to the Seven Brothers fairy tale with the young men who were turned into swans and their sister has to make a nettle, seven nettle coats for them to wear and turn them back into men and she can't quite get the sleeve.
Because, of course,
on the
he has. And
done.
See, I wouldn't have picked that.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have picked that because he has seven brothers.
He is one of seven brothers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're right. Yeah. Correct. Yes.
And in the fairy tale of this type of fairy tale, the maiden doesn't get to finish one sleeve on one of the last shirts before the deadline, and that's why one of her brothers is left with a wing. So there's little nods, and she's weaving this beautiful tapestry, but I don't think – I mean, obviously, if you know a lot about fairy tales and you're steeped in this sort of stuff, if you, for example, I don't know, spend 6 years writing a PhD around the subject, you'd get these extra little Easter eggs. And
can we get someone like that on the podcast?
I know, it would be really good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, great.
And so you'll have a different, I guess, approach to the book, and you'll have a different experience reading that book. But I don't think any of that matters, because, as you say, you're not overly familiar with a lot of that stuff.
I love the book.
And yeah, I think what Gilbert does.
The problem is with this, mm-hmm. for me, this is my personal reaction, is I'm loving it, and I'll get to that, my reactions, in a sec. But I'm also thinking, wow, this is really original stuff, and yet there are a bunch of people going, well, yes, but she's actually taking stuff that exists and twisting it, changing it, modifying it, whatever. Whereas I'm thinking, because I just don't know enough, this sounds all very new and fresh. Although I do know enough because I've read stuff outside this book.
Yeah.
But I can see younger Ian coming to this thinking that this was all, you know, brand new and fresh.
Which, but that's okay.
It is.
Like, I don't, but why is that a problem though?
I don't know. I suppose that it's now become this critic inside me that this is a real anxiety I have. Let's talk more about me. That
sit down on the couch, Ian.
No, because I'll tell you what it is. This is serious. You write a review and you go, oh, this is the most freshest, newest thing in the world. And then five people write in and go, oh, no, it's been done. It was done in the 1950s. But, you know, they're just basing it on X, Y, and Z, because you don't particularly have the cultural antecedents. And so you don't always – yeah, and that's the sort of thing. That's an anxiety and neurosis of mine.
I don't think it's just yours. I think it's an anxiety a lot of people have, and it's a, I guess, a dynamic that you see a lot, especially in some fandoms, where you'll get people who are new to a fandom and all excited about something, and then, you know, the people who consider themselves, you know, knowledgeable and established fans, like, oh, but you just didn't see back in season whatever, or back in, you know, the early incarnation of this particular thing that you love, blah blah blah, and it's like, so what? You know, No one comes into the world full of knowledge, and everyone's knowledge base is different, and we come to things at different times. And if you've read this book with no knowledge of fairy tales and it feels new and fresh and exciting, that's fantastic. And if a reader then goes, I'm going to read more like this, and then starts to read other books and then sees connections and links and antecedents, and, you know, I mean, that's what reading is. Like, it doesn't really matter which one you come to first. And I think we all need to be a bit less high horsey about what people don't know. And if someone says, this is amazing, and oh my God, the guy with the swan wing, wow, that was so novel, and I've never seen anything like that before. Instead of going, oh, well, actually, you go, yeah, but hey, did you know? There's these other stories and this whole thing, and these things interact. And, you know, if we approach this from a, hey, you didn't know this thing, let me tell you about this great thing I love, instead of, oh, you're an idiot because you didn't know, how much better would everything be?
Yeah. Look, you're right. And just to slightly change it away from my own neuroses, but what you've said is perfect. What I loved about this is that I usually – there are some people who love books about the natural world and the descriptions of the natural world. Normally they just wash over me.
Yeah.
yeah.
Normally don't care.
This though, not with this book, because of how brilliantly she integrates all that into the world she's created, and the storytelling and the fantastical elements, which are only minor. They're sprinkled throughout the book.
They're pretty major, actually.
Well,
this is one of the things that irritated me about several reviews that I kind of read, which I even read one, and now I can't remember where it was from, but kind of was saying, like, oh, you know, like, is the supernatural stuff real, or is it all just a hallucination from the people of Neverness? Oh. It's like, oh, it's real. Like, okay. Come on, please.
That's,
like,
that's clearly someone who's only read the final story, questions.
But it's the idea that we can dismiss these fantastical elements because they may be metaphorical or not. They're real. Like, the thing is steeped in fantasy. Like, almost every single story. Like, it is interwoven into the fabric of the book. Like, you can't say, oh, they're just kind of sprinkled. Like, just about every – in fact, just trying to – I don't think there's a single story which doesn't have a supernatural element of some kind.
Well, what about the opening story with the gorse?
Well, I guess you could interpret the ending as Crab's dying hallucination, or is it the actual gorse mother?
Yeah, well, but that plays into the review that you read, that – There are definitely
which
stories.
I will read it as the gorse mother. She's there. Like, this book is filled with that, and I don't – and once you once you're recognizing it as a mosaic, right, it's not a collection of 10 or however many there are short stories that have been collected together and here's your nice little collection. Once and it's not a novel, clearly, but once you read it as a mosaic, then every story connects with every other story and interlinks and builds and it's a whole picture. And if most of the stories are clearly and explicitly and undeniably, you know, supernatural and admit this other world of other non-human beings, then every story has to have that. You can't read one and go, oh, that might be some hallucination, because why would there be, you know, the mist selkie and the witchcraft and the guy who comes and stays for the month of winter and then goes away, and the water ox and the water bull and all these other creatures, and not a gorse mother? Why would that be? You know what
who
I mean?
Is the guy? So I love the story about the guy who comes for, you know, the couple
that's
of
one
months.
Of my favourites.
But that is a cracker of a story. But what's that based on?
I don't think
so. What is that?
I don't know.
He's not inherently supernatural, that guy. He just turns up.
Well, like, he kind of is, though. He kind of bespells the woman he spends the winter with. I mean, that's
maybe because he's well endowed.
In this story, she is so sick of him by the end, but she just can't. Like, she just
wants
him gone.
Well, that's what's really funny about it.
Yeah. And this is why I say, yes, there's a couple of stories in there that you could look at as they're you could give a reading of them that doesn't, that lifts them out of this place of, you know, the fae and the other and the magical and folk tales and lifts them out. You can say, well, that's really, you know, that's just, but they're not, you can't lift them out. They're part of the mosaic that is this book, and therefore the entire book is steeped.
No, but I agree with you. And look, deliberately, even if you could read it in that secondary way, it has a deliberately fantastical aesthetic.
Absolutely.
It's not being shy about that. And Neverness, is Neverness a real place? Does Neverness exist in the mimetic natural? It's not. The point is, this is not naturalistic fiction in any way, shape, or form.
No. There's this beautiful. It reminded me.
By the way, and before you say that, I mean, the review that says, "Oh, this is all just one big allegory for I don't know the current moment or something." You're missing the point. You're missing the richness of the story. I mean, it's about sitting around the campfire and telling really interesting stories, really beautiful, rich, deep stories that about people living in this world. Doing what it's deliberately a generation of that. So we see them get older, we see them develop, we see them change, we see their tragedies and their loves, and it's all of that all compacted in this one book. So to treat it as if it's a metaphor for something is a kick in the bum of Zoe Gilbert.
Yeah,
and the novel.
It is really a majestic book, and I loved it so much. One of the reviews, but the one that I took particular issue with is from The Guardian.
You're going to bring it up.
Yeah, it's from The Guardian. Benjamin Myers is the author of this particular review.
I love Benjamin Myers.
Yeah, look, it's a good review, but there's just this little bit which got my hackles up. And I'm just going to read you the line. He says, "Gilbert fashions a world of fairy-free fairy tales. Side note, most fairy tales are fairy-free. But anyway. Gilbert fashions a world of fairy-free fairy tales that is utterly believable. While folk can be superficially read as fantasy, the concerns of this community of entangled, troubled lives are always grounded in history." It's like, and that line, superficially read as fantasy, just stop. Just stop.
And this, look, I think Benjamin Myers is a terrific writer. He wrote a book called The Gallows Pole that came out in 2017, which is fucking amazing, and I highly recommend it. And please, people should read it. But that is dismissive. We already know because I spoke about it at the start of this podcast that there is a whole world out there of people who are very dismissive of the speculative and the fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just slight tangent, because we never do tangents on this podcast.
Never.
As you know, I read the Man Booker, or actually now the Booker Prize long list.
Mm-hmm.
The first two books I picked up, because I've just read them in any order, there's 13 books, a baker's dozen, whatever they call it. The first two books I picked up are both science fiction novels. Absolutely, clearly science fiction novels. One of them's a climate change science fiction novel, and the other one's partly set in the future. I mean, it has AI. Actually, the main point of it is about artificial intelligence. And you see, and yet, both the genre side of the world didn't pick up these books.
Mm-hmm.
We dismiss them. And the literary side don't treat them as such.
Yeah.
Just doesn't mean.
The divide, the divide's there. And part of the, not the divide, I don't think the divide is a good thing or a necessary thing in terms of how we value books and how we do or don't cross-read between genres. But I think the, you know, the categorization is often fair because it's not just subject matter that defines a genre. It is also, you know, approach and style and that sort of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of intersecting attributes, I guess, that places a book inside or outside of a particular genre. And sometimes that categorization is very fair. What is not fair is the value judgments around genres. But anyway.
Yeah, and look, I suppose if the fantastic gives you rabies, as it clearly does some, you can still read this book and love it because it's so the language is so lush and the characters are so memorable.
Yeah. Oh, the language is beautiful.
Ian, you forgot it. Ian, you read this book in 2018 and forgot all about it, but I remembered it as I was reading.
Yeah, right, and the language is so beautiful. And I think one of the reasons perhaps for both of us, the landscape and the natural descriptions of things was so engaging is because she doesn't just describe the landscape. She filters the view of that often through her characters and she modulates her language to reflect a character's perceptions and to, I guess, to kind of enmesh the characters and their perceptions within the landscape. And the landscape is a lot of the time feels very embodied and very personified, you know, personified is not even really the right word because that implies that we have overlaid something onto it. It feels alive. It feels like its own person a lot of the time. And it's really a masterful use of language in this book. And I loved reading this book so much. And it was, again, as I said at the beginning, it felt kind of like a loss when I didn't want to leave Neverness. I just wanted to keep reading these little slices of life about all of these people, some of which recurred and some of which didn't. But I, you know, it's a small village. I guess the book couldn't go on forever, but although it could if you just kept going forward in time. Imagine what happens when Neverness hits the 21st century.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, if it was in the 21st century, that the whole arrows and the girls shooting at the arrows and the boys running through the gorse maze to find them, you could use like little air tags on the arrows them with your iPhone or your Android phone. So, yeah, that and also you'd have the Find Me app on so people wouldn't accidentally get burnt to death.
But you probably wouldn't be using those in this very traditional ritual. You'd probably still just be using bow and arrow.
That'd be in the 21st century. Anyway.
It was a really dark book too, wasn't it? Like it was a really dark book.
Oh, yes.
And I think it says something to my reading taste, I think.
Without going into a gratuitous sort of, I don't know, rapey stuff, but some of this, there's hints of it. There's there's post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
There's the I can't remember the mother who basically just loses it after
depression
her husband vanishes.
There's children who beat an old lady almost to death.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Oh, that story. Whoa,
that's one of the best.
It's an amazing story.
Ooh. And you know the whole story around the violin, which was just beautiful and sad and tragic, and we're deliberately not giving away too many plot points, people.
Fiddle story.
I read this at the beginning of the month and I was just flicking through it again yesterday to remind myself of all the stories. And it's like, oh, God, that's right, that one. Oh, God, and that one, yes, and that one. And there is not a dud piece in this book. I keep calling them stories, and I'm kind of loath to do that because each one of them could be self-contained. You could lift each one out of it and read it, and it would be a good story, an exceptional story in some cases. But they're more than the sum of their parts when you read them together, and there's not a part in there that doesn't fit and doesn't add to the mosaic and doesn't build upon something or reveal another aspect of Neverness or another aspect of the characters or how people go about in this world. Every single story belongs in that in that mosaic, and I wouldn't take a single one out. And also, as much as I said that I was sad when it ended and I wanted it to keep going forever, they didn't feel like there are any gaps or holes or missing bits. I didn't feel like, oh, but I never found out about blah, 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 or, you know, it felt finished and contained, and this lovely world that I'd spent time in, sometimes very uncomfortable time. But yeah, it's such a good book. I cannot recommend it more highly enough.
So that's a good point to move on to Mount Weasels.
Mount Weasels. The Liar's so Dictionary.
So you can describe the back of The Liar's, was it The Liar's Dictionary? I don't know if it's the title of the novel. The Liar's Dictionary.
Sure. So this is off Goodreads because I read it on the Kindle. Peter Winsworth, a disaffected Victorian lexicographer, inserts false entries into a dictionary, violating and subverting the dictionary's authority in an attempt to assert some sense of individual purpose and artistic freedom. In the present day, Mallory, a young, overworked and underpaid intern employed by the dictionary's publishing house, is tasked with uncovering these entries before the work is digitised. As the novel progresses and their narratives combine, as Winsworth imagines who will find his fictional words in an unknown future, and Mallory discovers more about the anonymous lexicographer's life through the clues left in his fictitious entries, both discover how they might negotiate the complexities of an absurd, relentless, untrustworthy, hoax-strewn, undefinable life. I don't like that blurb.
No.
It's all round.
Struggling there with some of those. You're struggling there with some of those sentences.
It's. Like, it's all – like, none of it's wrong, but it's all kind of in the wrong order, and it doesn't – I recognize the book I read in that blurb, but it doesn't really describe the book I read.
You know, I'm always fearful that every time we say a blurb's no good, it's the one that the author wrote. Do authors still write their own blurbs? Does that still happen?
A lot of authors do. I mean, yeah. And look, and part of it is, like, a blurb is – you know, a blurb's job is not to give a faithful representation of the book, right, utterly. It is – to entice a reader to read it. So, you know, they're going with some of the features there, and I mean, as I said, it's not like it, I can see the book I read in that blurb. It's just, yeah, it feels like a different, it's describing a slightly different book. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a blurb.
This is the question that popped in my head while I was reading it, which was, were you aware of Mount Weasels? And we'll have to explain what that is for people who aren't. Were you aware of Mount Weasels before you read this novel?
Of course I was.
Of course.
Mount Weasels and
explain what a Mount Weasel is.
And Phantom Streets and all those things. I find them amazingly fascinating. So a Mount Weasel specifically is a word that is made up, which is like all words are made up, but an imagined fictitious word. It's so hard to talk about this after reading the dictionary. But a fictitious word that is inserted into a dictionary, or in this case, Mount Weasel was an entry into an encyclopedia, which is where it came from, which is completely fictitious, and it's put there as kind of a trap. So if someone else comes along and goes, oh, hey, I want to make a dictionary. Look, the Oxford looks pretty good. Maybe we'll just copy that. You know, they could then, the makers of Oxford could look at their dictionary and goes, aha, you've got that word in there, which isn't a real word, and we put that in there. And it's done in other things too. So in cartography and map making, they'll often put something in there which isn't real. And I know in like street directories, it's quite famous that they'll often be on a map, on several maps throughout the book, like a little, usually a court or something. So not a street that anyone is going to go to in a map. So not something that seems to connect to another street or anything like that. So no one's going to get led astray by it. But it will be this little fictitious court or dead end something which isn't real and isn't actually on the map. And but it's put in there by the map maker. So if someone copies their map instead of going out and doing their own map making from scratch, they'll know because you took that fake street which doesn't exist in the world. And it's so fascinating. I love the idea of these, you know, phantom streets and fake words. And I absolutely love it.
Well, the cartographic one I was aware of because I think there's about 25,000 fantasy novels that use that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, it's not that I knew, but I didn't know about the copyright usage or the copyright trap in dictionaries.
That dictionaries, encyclopedias. Yeah, yeah,
It's a brilliant idea.
It is.
So that is not the only point of this book.
No, Williams uses she has a couple of like actual Mount Weasels, like known Mount Weasels that she's used in a couple of chapter headings, and she's also made her own up, obviously, and inevitably all of the Mount Weasels that Peter Winsworth is putting in his dictionary, Williams must have made up, right? Because they are these made up words, and some of them are so delightful. I want them to be real words.
I didn't note them down. That's the only thing. But anyway, look, we should say that we've got two separate timelines here, which the blurb sort of explains.
But it starts with Mallory. The book opens in the present timeline.
Yes, opens in the present time with Mallory, and that's in first person. Mm. And the past stuff is in third person. But omniscient, what do you call that again? Omniscient, character?
Yeah, I felt that was third person direct. There wasn't really anything in there that Peter didn't know and wasn't thinking or feeling or knowing, so I would say that's third person direct.
And the two storylines obviously do interact in some way, and there are these beautiful parallels, including explosions between them.
Yes.
But obviously the key element is Swansby's Press, which is obviously a fake press.
I so wish it wasn't. I really wish there was this incomplete dictionary out there.
Correct. Which is another great idea. And it's a folly. I mean, that's basically what Swansby is. It's a folly. So,
I mean, it didn't start off as a folly, right? It started off they were going to make an encyclopedic dictionary, and the First World War, was being made at the end of, towards the end of the 19th century, and the whole project was derailed with only a couple of letters to go by World War One, and all the lexicographers and the people working on it, most of them went off to the war and died, and there was no one left to finish the dictionary. So it was this unfinished dictionary, and that has been its kind of point of interest, I guess. And now the current Swansby, is his project, allegedly in the book to begin with, is that he wants to digitise the dictionary, still keep it unfinished, but update the words that are included. So don't add any other words and don't finish those last couple of letters, but update the definitions. And this is ostensibly his current project to make it a digital updated
edition. And the nominal catalyst for the action initially is that one of the words they've updated, I think, was marriage.
Yeah.
Where they've, they've changed from a man to a woman to
two
obviously
persons.
One that's contemporary, to two people. And this has now caused a bunch of people to ring into the dictionary.
Well, one, it seems to be one person.
Well, one person, correct. One person to ring in the dictionary, make threats.
Like on a daily basis.
Correct.
Yeah. And one of Mallory's jobs is to answer that phone.
Mallory has the job of answering the phone and hearing these vicious threats every day. And of course.
No, I was just going to say, which is a weird, at the beginning, she kind of says that's kind of her main job, which is a weird job. But you kind of don't question it, because the book has this, delightful is a word I'm going to use a lot with this book, but it has this kind of ludicrousness set up almost from the beginning. Yeah. So you just don't kind of question that this is the job she has. And then, of course, by the end of the book, you know exactly why that was her primary job.
Yes. But let's be clear. This is a book that, apart from the preface, which is a piece of genius about prefaces in dictionaries.
I had forgotten about the preface till I went back and skimmed through the book again.
Just
so good.
You know, what's the mind-blowing gif? It's just amazing. The next chapter is essentially Mallory in a closet eating an egg.
Two boiled eggs.
Which she does on a daily basis, by the way. This is her thing, going to have lunch with two boiled eggs in a closet or cupboard. And he, David Swansby, who's this eccentric
rich.
He's just talking to her.
And she's got these eggs in her mouth and she can't answer him.
Correct. If that doesn't set, beyond the preface, if that doesn't set the tone for what's to come, you know, if you read that section, you go, oh, don't get this. Maybe
this
put the book
this
down
is a bit silly.
Because it's a bit silly, because that is what, and again, it's one of those books that is playing clearly to that ludicrousness that you just said. But
with a straight face, with an absolute straight face.
Yes, it's so earnest.
So wonderful.
Because it has one of the greatest scenes in literature.
The pelican scene.
Beautiful. How did you know?
The pelican scene's so funny.
I've not read anything funny out in years. Honestly. And there's this big thing at the moment, because I listen to lots of podcasts about books, about how poor comic books are at the moment. There aren't many good comic writers in the literary world. Genre put aside, but in the literary world particularly.
Eli Williams is so funny.
Up for any failures around comic books that exist in England or
it's US so
at the
funny.
Moment. This scene.
And the fact that like scene, she it's and it's a double joke. Like, and she breaks it up between two chapters, and the first joke is that, and sorry people, we're just gonna spoil this.
You've got to spoil it, go ahead.
So so you've got Peter who's got this crush on this woman who he's met, and he sees her in a park and he appears to be strangling a pelican. And he's horrified, and so are a couple other lookers on.
There's a mother and son who are just watching aghast.
And this woman is strangling a pelican. And after a while, Peter thinks, well, I might just go over and see what's happening and tell her to stop. And he gets, because he's got this very romanticized crush on her and he thinks he's in love with her, he goes over and he sees she's got a cut or something on her forehead and she's bleeding. And so he goes from being really like aghast and horrified and what is she doing to thinking the pelican's attacking her and she's defending herself, and he just starts punching the pelican, and end chapter. And then you go back to Mallory for a chapter, and that's like that switch in Peter, and the image of him punching this pelican.
He's just punching the shit out of this pelican.
It's just hilarious. Like, it's horrible, people. Don't punch waterfowl ever. Even if they're attacking you, just run away. But the way Williams has written it is freaking hilarious. And then you have a chapter with Mallory, and then we go back to Peter and what's her name? Sophia? God, I can't remember the woman's name. Anyway, and back to that thing, and then the second joke, the actual joke, the better joke, the joke that the first one was just a hand wave from to distract you, is that she wasn't trying to strangle the pelican. It's got something stuck in her throat and she's trying to hold it down to help it. And then Peter's come along and just started laying into this poor bird. I'm just so, oh God, I can't stop laughing.
It's the way it's written.
It's so funny. Oh my God, it's so funny. And just the way it's handled, and the like that deadpan line when they've kind of, settled the bird down and they're trying to see what they can do. And, he's saying, oh, it's not really looking good, like its eyes are a bit. And she goes, yeah, well, I don't think punching it helped.
And the other thing, she takes his pen.
Oh, gives it a tracheotomy, yeah.
Gives it a tracheotomy.
So it can breathe.
Then says, oh, well, I've ruined your pen. Well, let's go. I'll go buy you another one. And
it's the pelican. Well, oh, my God. It's so funny. I was laughing at, and as you heard, listeners, I was laughing just telling you about it. It's so funny. Yeah. And it's so beautifully written. Just deadpan. It's the book is telling you jokes, but it's written as though it doesn't know it's telling you jokes. It's not going, hey, look how funny
it's
this
dry.
Is.
It's very just, dry.
It's look, wonderful.
There's a wryness to it at times. Yep. Obviously, there's a wink. But, oh, wow.
And you know I often get – I often feel that books that are written in multiple points of view. So we've got Mallory's in first person and Peter, as we've said, is third person, pretty much direct. And they often don't work that well as a cohesive book. I personally, it might just be me, I often find it a bit jarring to switch between, not so much switch between characters, which is very common, but to switch between a first person and a third person point of view. And The Liar's Dictionary, I did not feel jarring at all. It may be just the first time. It was because we started off with Mallory and a first person narrator, and then suddenly you switched to Peter. And it's like, for a second, I was like, oh, who's narrating this?
What's but also, it's not entirely clear from the first few pages where that's. I mean, we know it's said in the dictionary, but when that's
yeah. So, but she melds them really well, and after the first change, I no longer felt disoriented or anything, and she writes those two different perspectives and point of view changes really, really well. And the language of Peter's sections is fantastic. It really does feel late 19th century. She's done such a good job.
Yeah, and we should say that
the dictionary
is the colleagues out there are very much toffs. It's something that's really interesting about the book, that the people who have the jobs are very much high elite aristocrat type people. It's because of course education is pivotal to a book that's about about writing a dictionary. So everyone's there is very plummy, and they all know their stuff, and that they all love giving. They all just throw facts at each other, which is a great element to the book. But they're also pretty unlikable because they're all a bunch of pricks. And Peter himself isn't the most likable person, but he's the most likable of the bunch because he's teased. That's another joke.
He has a lisp, but he doesn't have a lisp.
Well, he gets the job because he puts on a fake lisp, which
he kind of doesn't do deliberately.
No.
It's like there's a thing.
Geroff, or whatever his name is, the guy, the previous Swansby, feels sorry for.
Yeah.
And so gives him the job. So he then feels obligated to keep
lisping. He has to maintain this lisp.
He maintains a lisp.
To keep his job. Oh, there's so many. And they're just like, I guess, the story.
And of course, he's also treated as invisible.
Yeah.
He's considered lower caste than everyone else around him. Literally, he sits between two people who just talk over him throughout the whole book.
He's a very passive character.
Yes.
Like it's
and that is the point of the book, by the way. Mallory and Peter are two passive people.
Yeah.
That is what they are. And both of them are having a reckoning. One is having a reckoning about her sexuality and how she's going to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the other one is having a reckoning about, well, who the fuck he is and what's important to him. And, you know, and he has a dream about what living out in the middle of nowhere in a hut or something. But
yeah, a little cottage at Land's End or somewhere like that. Yeah.
He did perfect in lockdown.
Oh, wouldn't he just?
he'd be spot on. And it's about both those guys becoming not more active, but making decisions, having more agency in what they want to do moving forward.
But
that's the beautiful thread that runs through the book.
It's also, though, like it's interesting because, yes, I'd agree with you that they're both quite passive characters, but one of the things the book does really well is – I think undermines that very, I guess, standard view. So when we often think about characters and sometimes people, it's like, oh, they're either passive or they're active. Yeah. And we don't interrogate that very much. And I think one of the things that Liar's Dictionary does is point out that some people that you may perceive as passive and their personality type certainly may be, you know, gentler and less less willing to take risks perhaps and that sort of thing. But at the same time, with both Peter and especially with Mallory, what can they do? Like situationally, where they are in their society and the opportunities that are available to them, there's not that many, especially with Mallory. What else is Mallory going to do?
Mallory's partner, Pip, who is an extraordinarily great character.
I love Pip.
Pip had a crack.
I was so terrified she was going to be dead in that bit.
Yes.
And I don't know that I would have forgiven the book if that had happened.
I'm with you. And Pip, this is a really good conversation about Pip saying, you know, there's no need to be in the closet anymore, Mallory. This is not – we've moved on. The world's moved on. What is this? What is this stopper? And it's that's the thing. It's a story about that, about what is stopping her. What is what is stopping Mallory from realizing who she is and her sexual identity. And I love that. And it's subtle. It doesn't bang your head. Because in the same time, it's also dealing with language. We haven't spoken about that, how the very – feel and shape and sensation of language in your mouth is so critical to this book because the words, the made up words are so
I've always loved this, like the sound of words. Like it's a big part of word appeal for me is the way they sound and the way you say them. Just to step back a little bit though to Mallory and Pip and that thing, one of the things when I was thinking about it in retrospect that is so clever about that and subtle, really subtle about that whole, I guess, storyline is that, you know, so Mallory's not, she's not really out and she's definitely not out at work. And what's really interesting is she's not out to the reader either until just before we meet Pip. Because you don't get, a pronoun until she makes that one call before she thinks the building's about to explode and you get she. And Pip can be either. Pip is short for Philip.
Correct.
Pip is, you know,
well, it could be a resurrected Dickensian character.
You barely, I guess so, but she barely mentions Pip, and when she does, it's very vague. And you don't yep. even really kind of notice it until the first time. It's like, oh, Pip's a she. It's like, oh, she wasn't out to us, the reader. She wasn't even out to us.
I know.
Like, she's so compartmentalized her life that when she's telling the story at work about work, so she doesn't even mention any of that. You know, it's so subtle but really beautiful. So we, the reader, don't even get to know that until we absolutely have to, when we see Pip. So it's very clever.
It's all set up. I mean, this is someone who hides eating lunch or eating boiled eggs in the closet. I mean, literally, she's in a closet. I mean, it couldn't be, you know, she starts in
a closet. Yes.
In a closet. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I mean, when you think about it afterwards, you go, wait, isn't it on the nose and obvious? But no, it's not.
It's not. Because you don't know at the time. You don't know at the time because she's in the closet, literally and figuratively. To the reader.
I love this book.
But there's so much just we're not even going to go into listing all the wonderful wordplay and the, you know, the descriptions of language
There's a whole section on the hourglass.
The hourglass.
It goes for like 3 pages, I think.
Yeah.
It's not much to do with the plot.
Yep.
But although it sort of thematically does because it's very much, you know, this whole idea of being on pause, you know, waiting, you know.
And I love, characters. I love like just to give like readers, listeners, sorry, an idea of some of the
things. I can see how excited you look at the moment.
Just some of the cleverness of this book. So just as a little taste in that hourglass section. It's Mallory, isn't it? Yes, it's Mallory talking about the hourglasses. Yep. And she actually kind of points out that because there's a whole lot of words, obviously, you know, in the late 19th century, there's a lot of current words that aren't in the dictionary that she's working on. But hourglass is, and she points out that, you know, this dictionary has it here and Swansbury's has hourglass, but it's hyphenated, hour-glass, which looks like an hourglass turned on its side. I went, oh my God, it really does. And there's things like that throughout the whole. Anyone who really delights in language and etymology, and you know, the meaning of obscure words and the fact that obscure words exist and all, like, is you're just gonna adore this book, like adore it.
It's a book.
Over and above the story and the characters, which is, as I said, delightful. The word play, the analysis of language, and the bringing to light all of these little so good.
It's a book with factoids that you feel the urge to check up. Wait a minute, is that true? Is that true?
One of the joys of reading this on a Kindle is with all of those obscure words, I could actually highlight them. It's like if they didn't have a definition pop up, it's like, Mount Weasel. It's just like, and then there's these, so there's these two things, and I don't know whether they're just slight errors in the book or whether Williams is so fucking clever that she's inserted these little factual Mount Weasels herself, like as a meta thing. And there was two that jumped out at me. The first one, actually I can't remember which one it was. I think it might have been first. So she talks about, time flies, which is the common translation of tempus fugit. But, of course, the literal Latin translation is time flees. Like F-L-E-E, like fugit, fugitive. Yeah, fugit, fugitive, right? It means the literal Latin translation is time flees. And it's commonly translated as time flies. And in the book when she's talking about that phrase, she says time flies. And I went, well, but that's wrong. It's like, and is it deliberately wrong? Because surely this book would know and this book would talk about that. So I was wondering if it was this little thing that is deliberately wrong. I'm not sure.
So basically this book has driven – what's the second one?
The second one's even better. This has driven me a little bit mad thinking about it. So she – and I don't even remember – I'll actually just find it because one of the other great advantages in reading on a Kindle is that you do get to just do a really good search. There it is. She's talking about her name, like, and it's about a third of the way through the book, and how other people see, like, where they think her name might have come from, et cetera, et cetera. And she says, in the past, I've been asked whether I was named after the vain, uppity character who doesn't kiss Michael J. Fox in the TV series Family Ties, 1982 to 89. I've been asked whether I was named after the psychotic wife who does kiss Woody Harrelson in Natural Born Killers, 1994. And there's a few others. Now, I don't know, listeners, who among you was also an avid watcher of Family Ties, as the folks in my family were growing up. But if you were, you would know that the character Mallory, who is indeed, you know, vain, I wouldn't say uppity, she was played more as dumb than uppity, is in fact Michael J. Fox's sister in the show. So of course she wouldn't kiss him. She's his sister. So has Williams made a mistake here in not remembering, or is that a deliberate Mount Weasel type thing that she's put in there for people who know and people who don't know? It's driving me a bit mad. That's how clever the book is, though.
Please listen to this episode and answer, please.
Oh, God, I'd love to know.
Yeah, but, well, look, but, and by the way, why did I choose this book? You haven't even asked me.
Why did you choose the book?
Why did I pick this book?
No, because you said last week you'd read her debut collection and really loved it. So,
Attrib, her short story collection, which won the Republic of Consciousness Prize, I think, off the top of my head. Literally just did that off the top of my head. Is extraordinary. And it's all about language.
I'm going to read that book now. I just love it.
So it's all about the difficulties of communication. And yes, you will love it because I loved it. Yeah. And I love this. They are different. In fact, this Attrib is not as accessible as this is in terms just of the – because this is a novel and it's telling a story.
Yeah.
Whereas Attrib is very much – the stories are quite short. They're very fragmentary at times and that. And it's far more experimental. I mean –
I think I'll love it. I can't imagine this author writing something I wouldn't love at the moment. we've talked a lot about, you know, how funny the book is and clever and there's all these little jokes and it's just a delight to, like, it really is. I found myself at the end of it going, or actually in the middle of reading it, saying to myself, this is just delightful. And I don't generally say that about a lot of books that I enjoy. Delightful is not really generally my wheelhouse.
And it is dramatic. Stuff happens. As you said yourself, you were frightened that Pip was going to cark it.
Would not have forgiven her. But I just also want to point out that over and above all of that, which is all true and wonderful and part of the joy of reading this book, it's got some very serious things to say about how we codify language and truth and history and facts and what something has to be for us to consider it to be true or otherwise, and is a fake word really a fake word if people, like, if it, like, all words are made up, right? Every single word has been made up at some point to fit a situation. So if someone makes up in the editing of a dictionary a fake word to describe the feeling of cobwebs, you know, going over your face as you accidentally walk through a spider web at night, and we don't have a word for that, well, isn't that now the word? Like, isn't that now the word for that? Once you've made up a word, however you've made up a word, this is how language happens. So there's a really interesting discussion all the way through the book about, you know, because David, one of the things when David finds out there are these Mount Weasels in the dictionary and more than one, and not for copyright reasons, because Peter Winsworth is doing them kind of for his own amusement and possibly for other reasons we're not quite sure, and in the book itself, that does it just tie in with his life and things like that?
It's not just his own amusement. Mm. He's doing them as a moment of rebellion.
Yeah.
Because I think of what happens. It happens after. Oh, look, I'm going to anyway. Mention the plot.
But, you know, so one of Mallory's jobs becomes hunting down these words. And she does so by searching through the physical index cards that originally comprised the dictionary and looking for the ones in Peter's handwriting. And Pip is helping to see if they're real words or not. But there's a lot of discussion about what language is and what makes a word. And it's absolutely fascinating. And that kind of spills over into how we perceive the world and how we codify the world, and can we really codify the world? Is it just a Sisyphean task? We should, I think the phrase that Mallory uses is like making a sieve for stars. Like you can't really contain language. As soon as you print a dictionary, it's out of date. The next minute, it's out of date because new language is being created all the time. So there's a lot of really kind of deep philosophical discussions happening below the storyline of this book. So it's just, I loved it. I loved it so much. It was, you know, it was going to end because there's 26 chapters. I start with each of the letter of the alphabet. So you know it's going to end. It's counting itself down all the way. And I got to about, I think, V, and it's like, oh, no. There's only three or four chapters left. Oh, no.
Well, it's interesting because especially in the Peter's story, it felt like there was a lot more to go, and we were already, like you said, towards the end of the
alphabet. Yeah, it's like, how is this going to happen?
Satisfactorily, but and somehow she does in the space of just two or three pages. She pulls it together.
Yeah, both storylines. Each of the storylines. It's funny. I was thinking about it, and I was wondering if each of the storylines, Mallory's and Peter's, actually work. Like, if you took them out and you just read that story, how satisfying would that be? And then I kind of slapped myself upside the head because it's a stupid question. Like, they work because they work together, and they neither has to stand alone. They work because they work together, and they work together.
There are things happening in each that are sort of reflected off the other. I mean, that's
absolutely. And together they make this extremely satisfying story.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Look, we're now repeating ourselves because this is
we are. we can probably leave it there. I think before we start repeating.
I think so, but you said delightful, and I think just right now, reading delightful books.
Yeah.
That have drama in them. It's not like nothing happens. Shit happens, but
it's delightful.
Aren't gonna gut you, but also have something to say. And a beautiful and a funny, so funny and so weird and just gorgeous.
And just playful, playful books. I love, playful. I really, really love this book. As I said, I will definitely track down her short story collection and keep an eye on the next thing that she publishes because I'm very, very keen.
Both of these books that we've spoken about today are perfect tonics for just if you need to just get away for a bit.
I don't know. I don't know if I call folk a tonic. Maybe for you and me, Ian, we're used to reading a lot of horror. I don't know. I didn't realise how dark a book was until I started reading some of the reviews and people are like, oh, it's really good, but it's so dark. And it's like, is it really dark? It's actually pretty fucking dark.
Okay, fine. All right, maybe don't read folk.
But it's good. Like, it's definitely
fiction. Certainly read and not feel the pressing nature of reality. Though it is all about consensus reality, by the way, let's talk about the current moment.
Yeah,
and talk about what we're actually going through right now around objectivity and reality and all that. It speaks to that, but does so with a smile.
Yeah, I love them both. Highly recommend. Really happy.
All right.
So, what is next month, Ian?
So for our, I suppose, Halloween-inspired episode.
I guess it will be, yes.
Didn't we do that on purpose?
No, it wasn't. I just picked two short story collections I wanted to read.
There you go. We've got Growing Things and Other Stories by Paul Tremblay and Let's Play White by Chesia Burke.
Yes, and I know nothing about them other than they have both popped across my radar fairly recently and were recommended. I know the Chesia Burke is an older collection. I think it's maybe mid-2000s. I'm not sure. I'd have to double check. But the Paul Tremblay is a bit more recent than that. But I've heard very
good. Paul Tremblay's
Yeah.
I think.
I've heard.
I'm sure it's this year.
Yeah. So I've heard very good things about both of them. And I will always at heart be a short story reader and writer. So I do love reading a good collection. So looking forward to
both. So I've read quite a bit of Paul Tremblay and very much enjoyed his work. Chesia, I may have read one or two stories, but not a lot. So this will be more or less a new experience for me.
Yes, looking forward to both of them. Mind you, it's a high bar. High bar for them to cross right after this month.
Yeah. if the Liar's Dictionary had a modicum of genre in it, I would be, as part of my year wrap-up for Locust, this would be probably my top book. It's
such
just
a good
that
book.
Good. But I can't really. Let's not go there. Okay. please send feedback by commenting at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. Send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. Have we received any emails?
Not this month, unless the account didn't forward them. But no, I don't think so. We don't get a lot of email generally.
I know people are listening, so write an email.
You don't have to write an email. Ian?
Or you can follow at Writer and Critic on Twitter, which we get the odd like. I could do for more, but all right, whatever. And please, if you'd like to, not mandatory, sponsor us on Patreon if you can.
We love our patrons. Thank you for those of us who are sponsoring us. And thank you for everyone who's listening. We really appreciate knowing you're out there and we're not just screaming into the void.
Yeah, although I would probably still do this.
You probably would. Yep. No, I'm loving the podcast again because it is bringing me things I would not otherwise have probably gotten around to reading myself or potentially even finding myself. So, yay.
Same here. And it's also we're doing it and I'm not having to drive 4 hours. So that's also a real plus.
Yeah, not much time being saved here. Still doing the editing. So.
Circus. And right now I would give anything to drive 2 hours out.
Maybe when it's all done, we should have a special in-person episode.
I definitely think we will do
Might
that.
Might be nice.
We'll do that.
Might be nice.
In fact, I may in fact bring my family along with me and they can
have a day in Ballarat. Oh, well, you know, if it's you know, by the end of the year or early next year, it'll be cygnet season again. Lots of baby swans.
Ah, do we belt the shit out of them?
You do not. They're not pelicans and they're not choking to death. So leave the swans alone. Plus, they will go you. Like, I would be – I wouldn't get within a meter of a freaking cygnet in cygnet season. Their mum and dad will go you.
Oh, that's the best note to end on. Do not melt the shit out of cygnets because they'll go you.
Not the cygnets, but mum and dad. See you. Bye, everyone. See you next month. No, they really will. They will totally go you. Jason was taking a photo. There was this cute little bunch of cygnets a couple of years ago that were really quite young. They were probably only about a month old, a month hatched. And they were on this bit of grass embankment and the mum and dad were kind of nearby but not too close. And Jason just had his phone up and he was taking a photo of the cygnets. And, you know, you kind of get a bit closer and a bit closer. And what he didn't see because he was looking through his camera was mum or dad, I don't know which one, suddenly careening down this little embankment with the wings completely out and flapping. I just yelled out, Jason, look out. He looked up and it's like, ah, swan. And he took this massive backward jump because this swan was not having it. He was way too close to their babies. And he was only like 2 meters away. Like he wasn't close, but oh, no, that swan was like, fuck off.